Apologies. I think that yesterday we noted at least 30 people registered to attend, so maybe there are stragglers still coming. And we did invite every MP and senator in the House and Senate. But this is the first one, and numbers are, I guess, having three roundtables is pushing it to try and get a big turnout for all of them. But I would like to thank all of the parties, the NDP, the Liberals, and the Bloc, for agreeing to co-sponsor the event. Just so that we're clear from the outset, we've made every effort to try and get the Conservative Party to co-host the event as well. Conservative MPs have also been invited to be panelists, and we'll continue to try and get Conservative MPs to be on the panel at next week's event. I know there are a couple of Conservative MPs who did register to attend, so that's encouraging. I'd like to thank just a couple of thank yous. Kea Chatterjee for flying in from, I think, D.C., is it? From the Worldwide Wildlife Fund U.S. for being here this morning. And, of course, all of the MP panelists who agreed to be here. We have an interpretation at the back, so if you need a headphone, please grab one. And without further ado, I'd just like to introduce Zoe Caron, who is a climate policy and advocacy specialist with the World Wildlife Fund of Canada.
Thank you very much, Fraser. Alors, bonjour tout le monde, bienvenue. C'est vraiment un plaisir d'être ici. Nous sommes ici pour parler à propos le changement climatique et le groupe de 8 et le groupe de 20. So welcome everybody. We are here to talk about climate change and the G8-G20. It's a pleasure to be here today. In terms of what I guess we're trying to do with these events is to bring together MPs and civil society to discuss the issues that are of the highest importance at the G8 and the G20. Of course, the other two roundtables that Fraser alluded to are on financial recovery and the Millennium Development Goals. I actually just got back from a G8 Sherpa meeting along with Robert Fox in the audience there, and so we had the pleasure of meeting the G8 Sherpas and discussing climate change with them. Of course, based on Chatham House rules, I can't tell you what we talked about, but it was good to have that dialogue with them, and so it's excellent to have that continued in this forum as well. The main issues, I guess, surrounding climate change on the agenda, which our panelists will speak to and our expert will speak to, are largely focused around climate change financing and commitments that have been made in global forums such as the United Nations. There's a lot of discussion around innovative financing and how that's going to play into the funds that countries put forward, both the short and long-term climate change financing. And of course, that goes towards developing countries for climate change adaptation, green fund technology, et cetera. So that's just to give you an idea of why climate change is an issue with the G8-G20. So without further ado, I'm going to pass the mic over to Kea Chatterjee, Acting Climate Change Director with WWF US.
Thanks, Zoe. So it's a good week to be talking about climate change. I'm giving a lot of talks this week, I find, and it's the 40th anniversary of Earth Day. In the United States, and I believe here in Canada as well. So it's interesting to sort of reflect on where we've come over the last 40 years. And I think that one thing that's really interesting is that when you look back at the history of Earth Day, you see that 40 years ago, one of the main reasons that people wanted to start an environmental movement was because they were really concerned about oil spills and they were really concerned about power plant pollution. We have the same issues today. We just know that it's much, much worse. So just in the last few weeks, we've seen in the United States, we had over 25 coal miners die in an explosion in West Virginia. We had Chevron spill 18,000 gallons of oil into a Louisiana wildlife refuge in the southern U.S. And globally, we saw a huge coal tanker crash into the Great Barrier Reef. These are the exact kinds of reasons the environmental movement came together 40 years ago and said, we need to have a bigger voice. we need to let people know we need to do something about this. Of course, now we know it's much, much worse than we thought. It's not just the effects of the oil spilling all over the reef. It's much worse. Fossil fuels are not only dirty and cause pollution, but they cause global warming pollution. So now we know that when we burn them, we have, we have an issue with excess CO2 in the atmosphere, which is actually acidifying the oceans. So that is affecting the coral reefs, because just like it's the same kind of effect you see in a soda can, when you have CO2 put into a liquid, it becomes slightly acidic, which is fine to drink, but it's not okay for coral reefs. The CO2 in the atmosphere is also causing temperatures to go up. You see surface temperatures going up. That also affects the reefs. And so the impacts of climate change have made it so much more urgent that we deal with these environmental issues that we've known have been an issue for 40 years. And we know what to do about it now. We know exactly what the solution is. And there are two things we need to do. They come up over and over and over again in G8 communiques, in the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. We need to reduce emissions, or as we call it, mitigate, and we need to adapt. We need to do both of those things. And if we don't do those things, there is another option, but essentially it's human suffering. And to the extent that we don't mitigate and adapt, there's human suffering. So in the example of the reefs, we have communities on island nations all over the region that have their food security put at risk because of the number of fisheries that are dependent on those reefs. Of course, we also have the impacts here in North America. In the east coast of the U.S., the government has documented, during the Bush administration, documented that the number of heavy downpours has dramatically increased, and that's been correlated with a crumbling of foundations of homes in the northeast of the United States. And so the impacts are everywhere, and the suffering is everywhere if we don't do these two actually relatively simple things of reducing emissions and preparing for the impacts. And the good news is that in the U.S., this movement is growing. So on Sunday, for the 40th anniversary of Earth Day, there's going to be a huge rally on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. And thousands of people are coming together to say, we want action from our government on climate change. And immediately following that, on Monday, the United States Senate will release their climate change bill. The House of Representatives, the other side of Congress, has already passed a bill in June, and this is the Senate's response. And there really has never been better momentum in the U.S. for getting this bill done. It's really incredible that we have one House that's already passed a bill. It's the first time in the history of the United States, certainly. And there's a lot of momentum on the Senate side. And so Monday's release of the bill will really be a very important moment in the history of the environmental movement in the U.S. and to some degree globally, because in the end, the U.S. is a good 20% of global emissions. And so the U.S. is catching up with the rest of the world, but it's important to note that these public movements are just are matched all over the world. WWF has an event called Earth Hour, where we ask people to turn off the lights for an hour to show their support for action on climate change. It doesn't just happen in North America. It happens all over the world. Individuals and families show that they want action on climate change. And they do that through a simple action in this case, by turning off their lights for an hour. And what we see is that from the pyramids to the Eiffel Tower to the Taj Mahal, all over the world, people really want action. They are trying to make their voices quite clear that they want governments to act on climate change. And governments, to varying degrees, are responding. And I think that what we've seen in the last few months is that far from being the end of a process, Copenhagen and the climate summit that we had in December was really the beginning of a movement. And it was a movement that's taken off in a way that we never could have anticipated. And it's a movement that is going to demand a response. And there are many opportunities to respond, and when heads of state come together, it marks a very, very important opportunity for governments to respond to this movement. And I think that part of the reason, what we're seeing is that some governments are moving. And it's interesting, I was reading The Economist on the way here, and there's an article in there about solar power that says that half of the manufacturing of solar PV cells are now happening in China. This is something that I don't know about here, but is very motivating in the U.S. In the U.S., there used to be this feeling that we were, chasing China somehow to try and get them to act. Well, now it's clear we are chasing China, but it's because we're desperately trying to catch up with China. And you know, we saw in Copenhagen that there are lots of other countries that are moving too. The G8 countries have a lot of traditional leaders among them. Certainly the EU countries have traditionally been leaders. They've got an emissions trading system in place. There are some countries within the EU, like Germany and Spain, that have really impressive policies of feed-in tariffs that have done a very, very good job of disincentivizing the use of fossil fuels and incentivizing the use of clean energy. Japan, for the first time, has put forward their emissions trading system with a 25% reduction below 1990 levels target, a very impressive target that they've solidified since Copenhagen. Even Russia has a new climate change doctrine, which includes for the first time both the impacts of climate change and the need to mitigate the effects of climate change. And so the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, you know, it's the treaty we talk a lot about in the U.S. because it's the one climate treaty that we have ratified, but and the Kyoto Protocol are very, very important documents and important processes. And in the end, the UNFCCC is the central place where we're going to be making decisions about climate change. But what we've seen is that process is moving, and every once in a while needs kickstarts, both from the public to show that we demand action, but also from heads of state to show that they're watching that process and support it and want it to move forward. And I think a lot has been made of what we did not get out of Copenhagen and out of that climate summit in December, and what we didn't get was a treaty, and that was very disappointing to those of us in the climate movement, because we felt like we created a big moment for them. We brought the public out into the streets, we harassed the heads of state into going to this event, and we created this moment for them, and we feel like, you know, we brought the horse to water, and it didn't drink. And I think that since then we've realized we got a little bit more than we thought. We maybe did not get the horse to drink. We did not get the treaty, but we did make the horses a little bit thirsty. There were three, you know, technical outcomes from Copenhagen. That if you just look at it technically, what happened? You know, we got an extension of the mandate. We got some draft texts on technical issues, on forests, on adaptation, on technology. And then we got this document, the Copenhagen Accord. And if you look carefully at this document, the document itself will probably fall to the side. But there were some real achievements in what heads of state agreed to and need to continue to reiterate. And again, there are three major things that were quite impressive that we got at Copenhagen. One is that for the first time, we have targets from all the major economies of the world. We have actions. We have clear actions. We know what they're planning to do. And many of these countries will exceed these actions. Now, on the downside, these actions do not add up to what the countries collectively said their aim was. They said their aim was to limit warming from warming beyond 2 degrees Celsius. But when you add up the actions, they don't actually quite get you to a point where you're consistent with the scenarios that would reach that target. But we still, we got these very concrete actions out of countries. The second thing from a U.S. perspective that was pretty important, the targets was pretty important from a U.S. perspective because we had never gotten the U.S. to actually put a target forward. But the transparency agreement was also very important. It was a huge stumbling block between the U.S. and China that was really threatening the negotiations for a very long time, and it was good to get beyond that and to get an agreement on the level of transparency that was needed. And then the biggest thing that allowed us to come out of Copenhagen feeling like we really might spark a global clean energy revolution was the agreement on finance. There was a real acknowledgement that we're going to put in the resources that we need to make sure that globally we are able to spark a clean energy economy. And we are going to help those countries that are suffering from the impacts of climate change today. And so there was an agreement on fast start financing, we call it. So it's $30 billion between now and 2012. And then there was agreement that by 2020 we would be raising $100 billion annually for climate change. Since that meeting in Copenhagen, there has been another UNFCCC meeting in Bonn, and the process is moving forward. There was an agreement, there will be a big meeting in June, there will be two additional meetings in the fall, and in Cancun there will be another conference of parties where a lot of those draft texts that came out in Copenhagen will be finalized. And so there's a lot that the G8 and G20 process have done and can continue to do to build momentum into the UNFCCC process. And I think that I see it really as an opportunity. In Washington, D.C. last week, we had this nuclear summit. It was a huge public relations event in many senses. It was a huge success. And I think that the G8 and G20 can be an equivalent opportunity for Canada. It's really an opportunity to move things forward and also to create some momentum within the process. And on climate change, I think there are, again, three areas where there's a lot of opportunity. I think the first is on finance. There has been movement on finance even since Copenhagen. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon appointed a high-level advisory finance group, which has already met and has reported to the UNFCCC process, and they're working on long-term finance and sources. But what we haven't gotten is a really strong political statement from the countries that think of themselves as donor countries about what's the character of this finance is. The biggest fear of developing countries is that this money is actually taken away from poverty alleviation money, and it's put into climate change. And that doesn't work for them for obvious reasons. We have a poverty crisis and we have a climate crisis. Taking money away from the poverty crisis to help the climate crisis is not really solving the social problems that we, and, or environmental problems that we have. Climate change exacerbates poverty. It's not the time to be taking money away from poverty. So we are really looking to the leaders of the G8 to make a very clear statement here that this money that we are going to identify to deal with the climate crisis is not going to take away from poverty alleviation money. It's going to be new and additional to ODA, to official development assistance. And that could be a very, very strong political statement that a process like the G8 can deliver, but it's much, much harder to deliver in something like the UNFCCC, where you have all the countries of the world, not just the group of countries that tend to be providing the finance. The second really important political statement that the G8 and G20 process could deliver is addressing the gap. I mentioned before that there's this gap between the actions that have been committed and what's needed. So if you look at the Copenhagen Accord document, for example, it says very early on that countries agree to limit global average surface temperatures from rising beyond 2 degrees Celsius, and then the numbers don't quite add up. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that for the sake of honesty, but also for the sake of setting up a process to address that gap. It doesn't have to be in the UN necessarily. You could set up a process under the Montreal Protocol or in under various settings where you can address this gap. But we need a political acknowledgement that this gap exists, and we need a process for understanding how leaders plan to close this gap that exists. And then finally, I think that the last thing I'll note that the G8 and G20 can do very effectively this year is build on a success that they had last year around fossil fuel subsidy removals. We know that fossil fuels are much, much more expensive than the cost that we pay as individuals for them. We know that because of the things I was just talking about. I know that the U.S. federal government puts a lot of money in when there's a coal mine explosion, but I never pay for that when I plug something in my house. Not only do I not pay for the full cost of the fossil fuels, the pollution, the damage it's doing to the planet, but those fossil fuels are actually being subsidized. And in the G8 countries, there are a lot of production subsidies. And so if the G8 countries as a group can show some leadership and build some momentum before the G20 even meets and agree to additional fossil fuel subsidy removals, then I think that can really build some momentum. And then you can bring, you know, Saudi Arabia into the room in the G20 process, and you can really get somewhere in terms of implementing the agreement that heads of state already made last year to remove fossil fuel subsidies. So I think I'll leave it at that with one last sort of comment about the G8, which is that, you know, this is the 40th anniversary of Earth Day in the U.S. In the U.S., that's when the Environmental Protection Agency was established. That's the first time we had an equivalent of an environment minister. And so it seems like a really, really bad year to set this very odd precedent of not allowing the environment ministers to speak in advance of a G8 meeting. And so I think it's really a shame, particularly in this year, to leave the environment ministers out of this process. And I think that it's going to make it harder to raise the profile of climate change and other environmental issues within the G8 without that environment ministers meeting. I don't know if it was an oversight to leave it out, but it certainly would be helpful to bring it back in at this point. So I think I'll pass it back to Zoe.
Merci beaucoup, Kea. C'est vraiment intéressant d'avoir une perspective de les États-Unis. So just to review what we're going to do now, We're going to go over to our distinguished members of Parliament in terms of giving comments back on this topic, and then we'll move to Claire, who's our civil society representative for the day, and then back to the members of Parliament. So we're going to get into a bit of a discussion here and lead into question and answer and discussion at the end. So without further ado, we'll move to Bernard Duclat avec le Bloc Québécois.
Merci beaucoup, d'abord pour,
first of all, for the organization of this event. I believe it is fundamental to hold this type of meeting. There are two opportunities that we're facing us. First of all, having this meeting a few days before the World Earth Summit is very worthwhile and very valid. And we must remember that today in Bolivia, there is a meeting in, that could be called the Porto Alegre of climate change. Various heads of state are meeting to discuss the issue of climate change, but more fundamental than that, the importance of earth, water, and air in our ways of developing our societies is a fundamental theme in industrialized countries in particular. And if there's a theme we should retain from this meeting in Bolivia, is the fact that we have to propose new governance, new environmental governance. We have to ensure that all players and actors in society, the elected members and representatives, as well as reporters, journalists, community organizations, people from the field of education, all of these people must for a time be able to place themselves on the fringe of the extreme events we're living so as to understand the elements that brought about the crisis that we're experiencing, because this crisis isn't just a crisis of environmental and climatic change, it's also a food crisis, a financial crisis. These are various crises that are such that we are experiencing all of these events today, and that is the G8's role. The role of the industrialized countries in particular, because yes, we're going to talk about climate change, but we'll also talk about development assistance, financial reforms, and all of these issues, all of these challenges must be intertwined so as to propose an international policy. And I would begin my intervention here with a phrase that I wrote here. I scribbled it on the corner of a table. The history of the G8 and G20 summits has demonstrated that these meetings are capable of the best and of the worst as far as the fight against climate change is concerned. So, to my mind, we cannot say that these summits aim at having us move back in time. No, we have to move forward, but at the same time, we still have too much ground to cover. Remember the G8 in Italy in July 2008, where the G8 countries, among them Canada, recognized in a common declaration that we had to maintain the average increase of the temperature on the Earth to 2%, 2 degrees Celsius. And that was a statement made by the G8 countries that was included in the Copenhagen statement, and it's a move in the right direction. Second element, let's remember the G8 held in Pittsburgh in 2009. There were financial commitments that were made in order to help developing countries adapt to climate change. Furthermore, there was a commitment to reduce fossil fuel subsidies and to incentivize people to devote more funding to renewable energies, but no targets were set for the short or medium term, but that was another commitment made in Copenhagen. To devote $100 billion a year to assist developing countries, but nothing was done with regard to reduction targets in Copenhagen. What does that mean? It means that the G8 and G20 summits will lead to concrete action as long as these commitments find themselves included in international agreements in the area of environment and financial and fiscal reforms. And this is the fundamental challenge. I believe that the next summit that will take place in Toronto will have to accomplish at least one thing. Leaders must recognize their responsibilities and historical responsibilities vis-à-vis the climate change crisis that we're experiencing. These industrialized countries must understand that if we're experiencing these natural disasters, it's because they have a historic responsibility, because our mode of development was such that we created the situation we now find ourselves in. And what does that mean? It means that if we have a historic responsibility, we must make historic commitments vis-à-vis developing countries. Two elements that I would like to dwell upon are the following. There must first be regulation. Industrialized countries must commit themselves to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, taking into account this need to limit the increase of the temperature of the Earth to 2 degrees Celsius above the temperatures during the Industrial Revolution. At the Aquila Summit in 2009, it was said that we had to reduce or limit the increase in temperature to 2 degrees Celsius. That was repeated at Copenhagen, and we cannot make concrete steps forward based on this. Otherwise, it would be a vacuum. So there must be this commitment on the part of industrialized countries. They have to commit to a reduction of greenhouse gases of 25% between now and 2020. And this commitment must be reiterated in the final G20 declaration. Secondly, industrialized countries must echo this recommendation of October 2007 of NATO, or rather of the UN, that said we should have a new Green Deal. We must use the means we have at our disposal to relaunch the economy while ensuring that we reposition the economy, Canadian economy, of course, but the economies of industrialized countries, towards the decarbonization of our economies based on investment in renewable energy. As Kia mentioned, China has risen to the challenge. The United States, let's compare the two budgets that have been presented, not this one, but the previous one, in Ottawa and in Washington. Ottawa didn't invest as much. Obama invested 6 times what Canada did with the conservative government a year and a half ago. So what were the consequences of this? Well, when we look at the recent results last week, for example, a Deloitte Touche report indicated that there's been an increase of 29% in our clean energy technologies over the last few years. To my mind, this is a challenge that several industrialized countries took on. Invest in energy efficiency. It's good for the economy and it's good for the environment. That is the first fiscal commitment. We must also, and I agree fully with the fact that we have to eliminate not subsidies in the case of Canada. We have to be honest here. Canada doesn't subsidize the oil industry in Canada. Canada grants fiscal incentives to this sector through accelerated amortization, capitalization, or depreciation of the investments. Since 1970, Canada has invested through fiscal incentives, $65 billion in the fossil fuel industry in Canada versus $359 million for renewable energies, which is pretty slim, without there being any environmental strategic assessment of each of these investments. So I believe, indeed, that the time has come to put an end to this fiscal incentive for the oil and gas industries, and the time has come to reinvest in renewable energies. We must naturally help developing countries. This is another commitment that's going to be made in the G20, because we mustn't just speak about the problems. We have to deal with these reinvestments, $120 billion, the Copenhagen commitment, but we have to find original ways of financing this aid, and I agree. This mustn't be included in the accounting of official aid, ODA. There must be a separate budget for energy-based assistance. Why wouldn't we create a new tax? Why wouldn't we have a tax on financial transactions? It's an idea I put out to fund adaptation aid, because we mustn't hide the truth here. There is money available, there are possibilities, but why wouldn't we establish a tax, a Tobin tax, on these various types of energy? I believe we have to think about this. I think this is a worthwhile idea, and we should have a debate on this, and I believe it would be a good mechanism to free up funds to help developing countries. So I would conclude on that, because I had 10 minutes and I don't want to spread myself all over the map, but I'd summarize as follows. I would say that the G20 summits have allowed us to move forward, but not sufficiently. These summits are an excellent lever to influence future decisions, but industrialized countries must take on their responsibilities historically. They must commit to reduce the rise in the temperature of the Earth. They must also commit to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by 20% between now and 2020. They must free up funds to help developing countries adapt to climate change. They must commit themselves to put in place a new Green Deal based on fiscal changes targeting the environment, and they must put in place rules and regulations pertaining to climate change. The Toronto Summit must serve as a follow-up and an exercise in advance of the Cancun summit. I participated in several meetings. I went to Kyoto in 1997. I participated in virtually all of these events. The success of these conferences is dependent upon the preparatory work, and I believe that the Toronto summit could be a good preparation for the success of Cancun. Failure in Toronto could represent failure in Cancun, and we must avoid this at all costs. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Bigras. That was excellent. And I believe that the responsibility of the G8, the most industrialized countries, is a very important element.
Welcome Linda Duncan, environment critic for the NDP. And I would also like to say that all the biographies are at the back, and I would highly recommend that you pick those up and read through them.
Thank you very much. Thank you for organizing these three forums and for including one on climate. I would add, if you're looking at my biography, I am no longer the vice president of the Sierra Legal Defense. In fact, it's now EcoJustice. So just for that clarity, they're nonpartisan. Thank you, Bernard. Bernard has clearly been at this issue for quite a long time, and I have a high degree of respect for his knowledge and his contribution on this issue. And I would just say ditto on everything he said. I will simply add to that my perspective. I have a slightly different perspective that I bring to the discussion on climate change, and it comes from my long 35-year career in environmental enforcement. And I have a legal background, and I actually campaigned on the platform of law and order for the environment. And nowhere is that needed more clearly than in action on climate change. I come to that for a number of reasons. Nothing disturbs me more than our government ministers repeatedly standing up in the House and saying, we're waiting for the United States. I find that extremely offensive, and I'm saying that for a very strictly legalistic reason. We are a sovereign state. Unlike the European Union, which is a union of states, and to a certain extent under the European Commission, Environmental Commission can actually issue directives that the member states are bound by. Well, we don't have that scenario under NAFTA, and we certainly don't have it under the North American Agreement on Environmental Cooperation. Now, it's unfortunate that that agreement isn't stronger, but the way things stand, yes, we try to cooperate. Yes, it's good that we consult with the United States and Mexico and other nations around the world. But when the rubber hits the road, it is our governments who are bound to take action to protect Canadians and to protect Canadian environment and to take action to implement their international obligations. Canada is also different than the United States on climate change. Unlike the United States, to its credit, Canada actually ratified Kyoto, and the United States did not. So Canada has a long-standing, since 1997, clear, legally binding international obligation to meet its commitments under Kyoto. And regrettably, 18 years later, we have done nothing except go in reverse. So that's the starting point for where I take a look at what is necessary for our country to do to live up to its responsibilities on acting on climate change. The second point that I would make is, as the inviter to the nations of the world to come to Canada for the G8 and G20, we should be the front of the pack, not the back of the pack. As the head of the International Energy Agency stated last week, Canada has a lot of work to do to try to get both its federal and provincial governments to take action to live up to our obligations on climate change. And so while they commended Canada for some work on carbon capture sequestration, which they would very diplomatically do is try to find something positive to say, the clear message I got of that, contrary to what Minister Prentice heard, was they are wrapping our knuckles again. The International Energy Agency wrapped Canada's knuckles at the meeting I went to in Bergen, where the minister repeated the line, we have to balance environment and economy. Well, I go back to the law again. Our ministers are mandated through the law. That's how they get their powers to take the actions that they do, whether it's to regulate or it's to decide not to regulate. And I've been writing repeatedly about this, like a broken record, about where the mandate for the Federal Minister of Environment comes from. It comes from the Department of Environment Act, and then a number of additional statutes that have been brought forward by past Ministers of Environment and enacted by Parliament. And the Department of Environment Act is very clear on the mandate for the Minister of Environment. His obligation is to protect the environment and a number of measures to be taken, including environmental impact assessment. There is absolutely no mention whatsoever in that mandate statute for the minister to balance his decisions with economic development. And to me, that is the starting point. And from my perspective, we need our federal minister of environment to start standing up for protection of the environment and let the other ministers of the cabinet take the other position and work it out there. I say it's also time to move beyond photo ops. I would say that a number of people are probably suspecting that the reason why we are the only country of the G8 that has yet to commit actual dollars on foreign aid to address climate change is likely we're looking for a photo op leading towards the G8 or G20. That's absolutely reprehensible. We need our country to step up to the plate just like all of the other G8 leaders have done and commit the dollars and tell us where those dollars are going to come from. The third perspective that I take is one on environmental justice. And it's a principle that has been implemented to a certain extent in domestic law. It's been implemented in Alberta law peripherally around coal-fired power. But it's a very critical principle, and essentially it says that no one community, or frankly no one nation, should bear the brunt of the impact for the public benefit of the majority. And by that principle also, those who cause the harm should compensate
to those who have been harmed. The third principle of environmental justice is participation. In other words, all people potentially impacted by decisions of governments should have a right to have a say and participate. And from my perspective, that means the civil society has to be given standing again in these major forums and should have a major role to play at the G8 and the G20 in Canada. I would think that would be one of the most important things that Canada can do. Historically, Canada has had a very good reputation on citizen engagement. In addition to that, the Government of Canada actually has a constitutional responsibility to consult and consider impacts on First Nations. So it has a dual responsibility to set an example to the world of this is how decision making should be being made on this critical issue of climate change. I certainly support the recommendation that there be a meeting of the environment ministers. It's absolutely reprehensible that that has not been included in the agenda yet, and I would encourage everyone to be encouraging the minister and the government and the prime minister to ensure that a meeting of the ministers occurs. I think that that's the forum to have the discussion about whether or not we should be balancing off the major initiatives we need to take to protect climate against so-called economic advantage. And we need the minister to reiterate his environmental mandate. Four actions that I would recommend, key actions to be taken. The first one is Canada needs to act. There's two things that we can do to help to address the impact on developing nations of the rising levels of greenhouse gases. One is, of course, assistance to developing nations to move towards a cleaner energy economy themselves. And in addition to address, to adapt, or to mitigate the damage already being caused. But the other one is for the major emitters of the world in the developing nations to take special action, to take intensive action, pardon me, to reduce our emissions. And nobody should assume that greater than the ones who have issued the majority of emissions to date and who have the economic capacity and have the capabilities intellectually and education-wise to act. So I would say the first thing that we need to do is we need Canada to step up to the plate, finally issue its regulations and its caps, and if the United States is slated to have the Senate issue their bill next week, then I guess we would expect that Canada will finally come forward because their last excuse would be gone. On the budget, I agree 100% with Monsieur Bigras. We need to be reconfiguring our budget. Right now, we have a budget that's called Jobs and Economic Expansion. There's no mention in there whatsoever of environment. And to wit, the budget delivers severe cutbacks to anything to do with environment, severely cuts back on environmental laws, and kills the main programs that would incent both homeowners and the renewable sector to expand. We need to be completely transforming our budget more in line with the U.S. budget. U.S., to their credit, actually removed billions upon billions of dollars in perverse subsidies. That was a commitment, as Monsieur Bigras has pointed out, and it's a commitment that Canada has yet to live up to. Again, in aid, there's been a lot written about that. I agree 100% that that the aid needs to be predictable, and I would say also budgeted. So I would say that what Canada needs to bring to the G8 and G20 table is some kind of actual regulatory or fiscal measure where they are going to actually deliver on their aid. And I agree with a lot of proposed mechanisms, the global financial transaction tax, the global currency transaction tax, and also the idea of emission allowance auction percentage. And I think that if the government is about to issue, finally, the long-awaited cap and trade regulations, that's an appropriate place to perhaps put that provision. But I'd also like to see the budget opened up and have some significant measures in there actually dedicated to ensuring those monies into the future. The final recommendation that I would make that is interestingly coming from a lot of more right-of-wing, right-of-center, pardon me, sources, and that's a call for a Canadian energy security and sustainability strategy. My party has long pushed for that. We have Canada West Foundation pushing for that now. We have the former Minister of Trade, Emerson, pushing for that. And that is the dialogue that we need. So we need to have an energy security and sustainability strategy, but it has to be done in consultation with all Canadians. And so from my standpoint, that could perhaps be the focal point for moving forward on all of these measures.
Thank you very much, Linda. I think it's really interesting to note that when we're looking for leadership from Canada as the host, it's not so much even leadership that we're looking for, it's simple responsibility as host to put forward regulations and to put its money on the table for climate change financing. Very ground level, basic stuff that we still haven't seen yet. We'll now go to Scott Bryson with the Liberal Party of Canada.
First of all, delighted to be here today, and I commend you for organizing this. I think it's, given that this is set as Bernard and I were elected at the same time, we've sat in five parliaments. This is the most toxic and sulfuric parliament, the least productive I've experienced, and it's nice to have more constructive fora to participate in here in Ottawa sometimes. It's up to you, civil society people, I guess, not the speaker, to facilitate that. I have great respect for both Bernard and Linda, and agree with most of what I heard here this morning. The one thing, though, Linda, I'm not going to repeat all that, but Linda said that protecting the climate from economic engagement or economic priorities or something like that. Protecting the climate from economic priorities. And in Davos this year, Stephen Harper said that any measures to address climate change will come at significant economic cost. And I will point out, in some ways, you're both saying the same thing, that economic prosperity and actions to address climate change are somehow mutually exclusive. And I think it's really important that we change the channels away from what it has been in the past, and that is a focus on environmental catastrophe to one of economic opportunity in the greening of our economies. And I think that's something we can agree on. I'm certainly not trying to compare you with Prime Minister Harper in any other way, because I'm very fond of you. Now, and I was... In 2008, if you look at the agenda for the Davos conference, you would think you were at a Sierra Club meeting. It was a very green agenda. In 2009, January 2009, everyone was shell-shocked because of the financial crisis. So it was as if the climate change wasn't an issue anymore. Everything was focused on the financial crisis. 2010, the two were brought together. It was a green economy focus, and the movement really was towards one of economic opportunity in the green economy. In fact, I was at a World Wildlife Fund roundtable dinner on January 27th at Davos, and the theme was "Let the Clean Economy Begin." And the only leader from any country anywhere in the world at Davos who was bringing the message that any measure to address climate change will cost jobs was Prime Minister Harper. Everyone else was saying that, in fact, there are great opportunities in the green economy, and, in fact, there's a real risk of missed opportunity for those countries and companies that don't move in that direction. And I don't know to what extent the IPCC challenge and the problems with the IPCC and some of the evidence, I don't know to what extent it has contributed to a skepticism on this, but certainly the enemies to actions to fight climate change are citing the challenges at the IPCC. So I think where we can all agree and where we can cast a broader net to attain more support for actions to address climate change is when we focus on the economic opportunity side. I think the G20 is a very important vehicle to address climate change, because it's also the vehicle that has risen as the most important organization or fora to address the issue of financial reform. And again, I think that we get very bad decisions when we create silos with economic decision makers over there and environmental decision makers over there and energy people somewhere else. We have to bring the three E's together, and I think the G20 is uniquely capable to do that. What we've just gone through in terms of the recession is not an ordinary recession. It has been a global economic restructuring. And smart countries and smart business leaders throughout history have used crises to create opportunities. And during this crisis, I've looked at, and this has been referenced by both Linda and Bernard, China's investment in greening their economy, using their stimulus package to make massive investments in green energy and energy transmission. The U.S., 6 times the investment, green investment, some estimates 14 times the Canadian investment on a per capita basis in clean energy. Korea, 85% of their stimulus package in green investment. And those countries have made a decision that this is where the world is going, this is what will create the jobs of tomorrow, and we're moving in that direction. And they've gone, you know, gangbusters on it. In 2008, China became the largest producer of solar panels in the world. 2009, the biggest producer of wind turbines in the world. And Vestas recently, or in last fall, built their biggest plant in the world, not in Denmark, but in Tianjin, China. And what was striking this year, in more than any other statement that came out of Davos, was that of Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican, South Carolina, who said at Davos, I've got the quote here, he said, 6 months ago, my biggest worry was that an emissions deal would make American business less competitive compared to China. Now my concern is that every day we delay trying to find a price for carbon is a day China uses to dominate the green economy. China has made a long-term strategic decision, and they're going gangbusters. And I had an opportunity to talk with Senator Graham both there and a few weeks later in Washington, and I asked him about what has changed your mind. And he said, first of all, where's China has gone, but also the Obama administration's commitment to nuclear has made a big difference, and that's an important debate. But they're part of what is moving the Republicans on carbon pricing in the U.S. is the Obama commitment to in nuclear and to further investments in nuclear. So I think that's an important debate we ought to be open to, or at least aware of. In terms of carbon pricing, I met in December Fan Gang, who's one of the top economists in China, and he is one of the people writing the next 5-year plan. And he told me during that meeting that China is considering a carbon tax for their next 5-year plan. And I asked him why. He said, well, the Americans are going to come up with something, and it will have a carbon tariff on it. We'd rather pay it to our own economy than pay it to the Americans. And I agree that the plan, the Lindsey Graham's plan, John Kerry and Lieberman plan has the best chance in the U.S. It's going to be important for us to watch that, because if it gets through the Senate by Memorial Day, it'll have a very good chance of passing fully before the fall. But if it doesn't, I'm really worried about any carbon price. If we don't have something before November, it's going to, if we don't have full passage before November, I'm really fearful because of what's going to happen in the November elections. In terms of sitting back, Linda was absolutely right. It is as offensive as a Canadian to sit back and watch us say, we're going to have a carbon pricing mechanism. As soon as the Americans get through with it, we're going to basically do whatever they do. I think that's really bad from a sovereignty perspective, but I think it's bad environmentally, and I think it's bad economically, because we're their biggest energy provider, and we ought to have a seat at the table when they're building a carbon pricing mechanism. We should be working with the Obama administration. We should be helping shape that discussion. We should be working not to wait for it to be imposed on us, but to actually help shape the outcome of it. And I think there are 3 areas of cooperation that we should be deepening in terms of Canada, U.S. on energy and the environment. Carbon pricing is number 1. Number 2 is energy grid modernization, transmission modernization. I think that's critically important. There's much more action in the U.S. on energy grid modernization than there is in Canada. And the best way to use less is to lose less. Most of us in Canada live in provinces where our energy grids are antiquated, and before you even flip your switch, you're losing 20%. The third area is in clean energy research and development. And not just in terms of areas of alternative energy, but in clean conventional energy. China and the Obama administration signed in December a deal to deepen their cooperation and to invest massively in CO2 sequestration. And the jury's out, but we're not going to know until we invest the money as to what the outcome, and I know there's some openness with the WWF towards that. But we need to recognize that given the remarkable and rapacious appetite for energy that's developing in the emerging economies, the world is going to need, I believe, all forms of energy. And it's incumbent on us to not necessarily exclude one or the other ideologically from the mix, but to seek ways and to invest in technologies to green energy production in some cases, and perhaps Canada's greatest contribution to this as a traditional conventional energy producer may be our potential contribution in clean conventional energy technologies. Maybe that could be our sweet spot if we invest significantly and if we cooperate with our trade partners like the U.S. and like China. Finally, I think on economic reform, financial restructuring, currency issues, the most important conversations are not going to be necessarily G20. I think there's going to be the bilateral discussions that are going to shape the world more than probably any other discussions are going to be the Canada-China, or rather the U.S.-China ones. And Canada, having had a privileged relationship with China for a long time, for a number of reasons, and being a friend of and an energy partner of the U.S., I think is uniquely positioned to help shape that dialogue on a range of fronts. And nowhere would that be more important for the future of the Canadian environment, economy, and our energy industry than on the area of the three E's, energy, economy, and environment. So I'd like to see a more robust effort by the Canadian government to be part of those discussions. I think it's shocking that when Canada has, in some cases, the most advanced efforts on CO2 sequestration in the world, that we were not part of that agreement in December when China and the U.S. signed that deal. I think we should have been part of that. Those are my comments, and I'm looking forward to having further roundtable discussions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Scott. I think the financial element is really, really interesting to think about in terms of where it overlaps with the environment financial, I guess, cross-sector, and particularly in terms of pulling together environment ministers. You know, maybe the environment ministers need to meet at the same time that the finance ministers are meeting and see if we can get some cross-discussions happening there in terms of green economy issues. We're going to now go to Claire Demers, who's the Associate Director of Climate Change with the Pembina Institute here in Ottawa. She's our civil society respondent for today, and she's going to both, I guess, respond to the MPs and to our expert, as well as maybe bring a few questions into the mix.
Ooh, some questions. All right. That's news to me, but I'm happy to make up questions. First of all, I wanted to say thanks to everybody for coming, and particularly to our MP panelists. I've been taking lots of notes. Those are some really, really useful perspectives, and I think it's, as some of you guys have mentioned, you know, there's some real expertise on this panel as well. These are people who have been grappling with these issues for a long time, so we're really lucky to have them here. I just wanted to quickly go through, you know, and I will try and be quick because so much has already been said, some of the key messages that we were hoping to raise today in terms of the G8 and the G20 and the opportunity that this presents this summer. Reflect back, as I mentioned quickly, some of the things that we've heard from our panelists and then open it up to those questions. And I think the first thing that we wanted to say is very straightforward, but unfortunately is at this point still a bit of a struggle, that climate needs to be an important part of the agenda. You know, this is the summer between Copenhagen and Cancun. You know, this is, as Scott mentioned, this is a time when all around the world people are recognizing the potential of the green economy, the urgency of what we need to do in terms of cutting emissions. You know, we've seen things like the EU heads of government put out a communique, I guess, last month,
saying that climate is so important that it needs to be raised in all key regional bilateral meetings, and they mentioned specifically the G20 meeting. That, unfortunately, has not been reflected in our government's approach to this. And, you know, as people mentioned, we're not having that meeting of environment ministers. But I think Scott and Linda would be given that discussion about the environment and the economy. You know, one of the things that really jumped out at me in Stephen Harper's speech in Davos when he presented his agendas for the G8 and the G20 was to say, you know what, G20, really big meeting, it's all about the economy. G8 can look at some of the non-economic issues, like climate change. You know, I mean, there is nothing more fundamentally economic than looking at things like the transition to a clean energy economy, that, you know, the green jobs that can be won. And I think for a lot of people, we've had this conversation come out about competitiveness already this morning. And, you know, a lot of us who work on environmental issues worry about things like sea level rise. For a lot of people, China is scarier than sea level rise in terms of what are going to be the consequences of allowing other countries to go forward and develop all of these technologies and solutions rather than having that development take place here at home. What are going to be the consequences for Canadian jobs, for Canadian industries? And we actually, we've done a little bit of a comparison that a couple of people have alluded to the spending that's taking place in the United States. So I just wanted to provide a mini update, but the 2010 edition shows that on renewable energy alone, the U.S. is outspending us 18 to 1 per capita, up from 14 to 1 per capita in 2009. So we're actually heading in the wrong direction. And that has very serious consequences that we hear about when we talk to people who produce green energy and they look to markets. You know, obviously the better opportunities now lie south of the border, with the exception of some of the provincial programs that are taking place. So Kea alluded to this. But I think it's really critical that the G8 leaders deliver on that fast start financing that was agreed to in Copenhagen. This is an essential step to rebuild trust in the climate talks so that we are prepared, as Belmel mentioned, for success in Cancun. And the other G7 countries, the other developed countries that are coming in, have all announced their contributions. Canada hasn't done that yet. You know, we know exactly what it is that we need to do. We have a very clear sense of what our fair share is, where the opportunities are to put that funding so that it really makes an impact. As Cam mentioned, it's critical that this funding be clearly over and above our official development assistance. So it's very clear what needs to be done, and that is one of the key things that we're going to be looking for this summer. But as Billy mentioned, you know, why wait? And as Linda mentioned, this needs to be done as quickly as possible so that we are in a position to play a leadership role as host. Then we've had a bit of a discussion already this morning that I really appreciated hearing about this question of the longer-term financing as well. So where are we going to find that $100 billion a year that's needed to transform economies in the developing world and to cut emissions and to adapt to the impacts of climate change? And, you know, as Cam mentioned, there is already a high-level panel that's looking at this issue. Now, there's eminent people from around the world, from leading developed countries. There are no Canadians on that panel. And I think that speaks to the role that Canada has played so far in this conversation, which is really to be missing in action. There is a menu of options that has been articulated already. So, you know, we've talked here already about things like auctioning allowances and cap and trade systems, which was part of the Waxman-Markey bill in the U.S. We'll have to see next week whether that's reflected in the Senate bill. But then internationally, the IMF has made an interesting proposal on special drawing rights, which I won't attempt to explain. I can't understand it. It's crazy magic money, but they seem to feel they can generate billions of dollars. A couple of our panelists have alluded to financial transaction taxes, really important source that needs to be looked at. There is also one that I'm a big fan of, which is generating funding through taxes or levies on emissions from aviation and shipping internationally. So these are sectors that right now aren't covered. They're growing. And we could be generating lots of money internationally to go towards these international priorities. And then one that I think, you know, last but not least, fossil fuel subsidies. Really, really key because it's so clearly on the G20's agenda. In Pittsburgh, leaders identified the need to rationalize, phase out inefficient fossil fuel subsidies, and they actually built in a specific requirement to report in Toronto on how they're going to do that. Now, you know, I don't always read my answer, but I pay some attention. I haven't seen anything yet from the Government of Canada as to their plan to rationalize and phase out fossil fuel subsidies. And we haven't seen that transparency yet as to what the subsidies, what the level of subsidies are so that we can work towards phasing them out. And the plan to do it as well is something that we absolutely need to see. Now, we did some analysis at the Pemina Institute back in 2005 as to the level. At the time, we found $1.4 billion annually. Since then, a couple things have changed. We've seen a phase-out announced that's going to kick in a year or so on one specific subsidy. We've also seen changes to tax rates. We've seen very direct investments in carbon capture and storage technology, which, again, under many definitions, including ours, would constitute a subsidy to fossil fuels in the way that they have been set up. So right now, you know, we're looking at, I would say, in and around $2 billion a year of fossil fuel subsidies from the federal government in Canada. Now, that's our back-of-the-envelope calculation, and it's one that there's going to be new analysis coming out between now and the G20 from Canadian experts who are studying this question. So we're hoping to have more hard numbers. But the bottom line really is, you know, we need those hard numbers to come from government and for those to be accompanied by their plan to phase out these subsidies. And then, as Kaya and others have mentioned, that provides a really, really important source of funding that can be used, again, for paying our fair share in supporting climate financing in developing countries. Because we do need to identify some creative ways to generate this money, ways that don't take away from the really critical poverty issues that you guys are going to be hearing about in the second and third editions of this roundtable series. So I think just to quickly reflect a lot of what we've been hearing about the need for leadership, you know, clearly the G8 and the G20 are not the fora where we're going to do the next climate deal. They don't include the most vulnerable countries, but they are places that can give momentum to this process. And Canada, given the timing of our summits, we really have an opportunity that I think is too good to squander. But as people have mentioned on this panel, you know, when you don't take leadership at home, it becomes far more difficult to be successful in leading abroad. And I think that's really been a missing piece. So we need to ensure that Canada doesn't become an excuse for other G8 and G20 countries to say, oh, you know, that's not the right place to have this conversation. This summer, this conversation needs to be had. The time is really, really short. If we're going to increase the level of ambition, as Kaya mentioned, you know, close that gap so that we can stay below 2 degrees, we can't be wasting the precious time that we have. So we've got really an ideal opportunity here to improve a reputation that's taken a bit of a battering and to help move this important conversation forward. So I think I'll just close on that, and we would love to take some questions from the audience.
Oh, no, I meant questions from you with a critical eye towards maybe our members of parliament, if you had any. If not, just a general response.
Okay, well, let me think about that, and I'll come back.
Okay.
If everybody raised some good points that I'd be happy to jump back in on.
Now we're going to go over to the members of parliament, and we'll just go in the same order again, and just as a response to Claire, so just a few minutes, 5 minutes each, and then we'll get into discussion. So just a response, and maybe with maybe in mind, you know, looking forward to the next 2 months. We have 2 months left before the G8 G20, so maybe with that frame in mind.
Okay, well, let me just, first of all, I should have mentioned as well that, you know, we did bring our little platform document, and being a good environmentalist, I only printed the two pages that you really needed on climate, so we'll pass that around. But in terms of, I think we had a really clear statement from all of our panelists about what they see as the priorities, what this meeting can accomplish. So just to make it, I guess, a little more practical, what in the next couple of months, because as Zoe mentioned, this is coming up very quickly, what can members of Parliament do to ensure that we do have the discussion we need to have this summer at the G8 and the G20, so in your role, and then any advice that you have for us in our role as civil society in order to make this an opportunity that we don't miss. So I think I would just start it off with that question to all of our panelists.
I believe that we have to start from a base that is more mobilizing so as to bring about real change. If we launch the discussion in the context of the G20, that's one thing, but I believe that perhaps we have to begin the discussion on the basis of the meeting that will take place in Cancun and the climate change forum. I think we have to discuss the ideas that will mobilize people more and that will allow us to move towards a greener economy. If I had advice to give, it would be to insist on the importance of countering climate change. The challenge of climate change must be the means to mobilize social society and elected reps, and not just starting with the G20. It's this discussion that we must have. At the same time, it is always difficult to have these discussions when the situation, the economic situation, is difficult. We often say that the environment is never the priority when things aren't going well financially, when the economy is in poor shape. And we feel that the economy is starting up again, the wheels are turning, and the issues relating to climate change must once again become the priority. I don't know what commitment we could make, but I know that in the coming days, we will be meeting with the Environment Minister at the Environment and Sustainable Development Committee on the Hill. We know that there are elements coming in the next few days. Should we perhaps call upon the minister himself? He does have a leadership role to play in this area. It is his duty to ensure that the political agenda for the G20 corresponds with his portfolio that he is charged with defending. So I think we have to require of the Environment Minister that he take on this leadership role and that he exert pressure on the Prime Minister so that this becomes a priority at the Toronto Summit. And obviously we have naturally a role to play. We're not going to be doing an open strategy session here today. We're not going to outline our strategy, but we're going to have to insist upon the importance of the leadership role that the minister has to play within the discussions of the government.
Really interesting points, Claire. As usual, you're always very eloquent on these topics. Amazing. You're an amazing Canadian asset. I just wanted to clarify a point that Scott Bryson raised, and to clarify it, if that's what you heard that I was saying, Scott. Far from it do I think that environment is not part of the economy. I, in fact, think that I know that the intelligent nations of the world are seeing action on environment and on climate as the solution to the economic recession. And unfortunately, our federal government, a number of provincial governments, have not figured that out yet. And that's what's so worrisome. There are lots of solutions out there. The fact that Obama has invested 18 times more money per capita than Canada this time around in the budget for incenting and deploying renewables is a huge blow to our once burgeoning renewable sector, which is a huge job creator, both in manufacturing, in deployment, in maintaining that equipment. You know, the killing of the home energy retrofit program is just killing lots of jobs, when in fact other countries are seeing that as a major opportunity
Britain saw it long ago, France is figuring it out, China's figured it out, and it's just very, very, very serious. When I mention the title of the current budget, I'm saying that simply that it's just excluding that word environment. One thing that certainly could be done leading into the G8 and G20 is to pass Bill 311. I mean, we will then have two things. We will have clear federal commitment to science-based targets, and secondly, the requirement of the accountability of our government to be taking action, reporting regularly to the elected officials on what they're doing to meet their internationally required and domestically required targets. I think that we need to keep in mind polluter pays. And one of the papers that Claire has written, I'm happy to see her raising that. That's a principle that I raise all the time and has been upheld by the Supreme Court of Canada, that Canada is bound by the polluter pays principle. I mean, why is it that our governments keep telling Canadians or trying to scare Canadians that, you know, cleaning up the environment, addressing climate change, reducing air pollution is going to cost us? It shouldn't have to cost Canadians anything if you actually apply the polluter pays principle. If we require coal-fired power to go to coal gasification, we address both pollution and greenhouse gases. We need our governments to be asserting their regulatory powers. It has been proven empirically in a number of studies that the best lever, the best trigger that industrial CEOs attest to is regulation. Why? Because it provides legal certainty. Why is a lot of the investment in the tar sands pulled back in the previous year? I don't think it's simply because of the economic recession. It's because of regulatory uncertainty. They do not know what the price of carbon will be. And so we need our governments to be doing what governments do. And governments are supposed to regulate. I think absolutely the biggest issue that we need to deal with are the perverse subsidies on fossil fuels. And we're going in the reverse of what we've committed to in Pittsburgh. The United States, in their last budget, actually took a huge slice out of their subsidies to fossil fuels. From my perspective, even though worldwide people are delighted that Canada is spending all this money on testing carbon capture sequestration, what it is a massive per subsidy of coal-fired power and the tar sands. And the big concern to me that I haven't heard addressed yet is, who's going to own that technology? You know, we have not had revealed to us in this very closed-door government what the agreements are in the transfer over of billions of federal provincial dollars, tax dollars, to a handful of industries to test and pilot these technologies. Who's going to own those technologies? Does it say in the agreement that Canadian taxpayers are going to own that because we put in billions of dollars? And the next, you know, the excuse for this is, well, we can assist China because China's building a coal-fired power plant every day as we sit here. Well, is China going to be able to afford our technology? So I think that there's a lot of questions out there that need to be addressed before we spend one more cent of taxpayers' dollars on that perverse subsidy. And yes, absolutely, let's all call for Canada to join that panel looking at long-term climate assistance. That's absolutely reprehensible. We're not there.
A couple things. And Claire's question on what should we be doing as members of Parliament, it's an interesting one that reflects, I guess, a challenge we have in this Parliament, because as individual members of Parliament, we don't have the same capacity to be the types of legislators that you can be, for instance, in the U.S., and the capacity to reach across party lines and broker deals that can advance, for instance, the pricing of carbon. Is not something that is a natural part of our system, and that's another discussion and one we ought to have sometime. But the capacity for a Republican to reach across to Lindsey Graham, to reach out to John Kerry, and to work with a Joe Lieberman in brokering and advancing good policies and ideas and legislation, I think is something that we should be having a more robust discussion about here in Canada, particularly in a minority parliament, because a minority parliament affords us a unique opportunity for a prime minister, for ministers to reach out to opposition leaders and critics and say, look, what should we be taking to the G20? What should Canada's agenda be on financial reform? What should our agenda be on climate change and international development? And legitimately and meaningfully engage opposition members. The opportunity is there. it's not being taken advantage of. In terms of what the government ought to be doing now, I mentioned earlier, and Linda mentioned the issue of energy security. Energy security is an area which brings environmentalists, business people, and economic thinkers, left-wingers, right-wingers, everybody, Americans, Canadians. The energy security issue, position, I think, is a really important one, and talking about environmental sustainability and energy security. And I do think we need to deepen our cooperation and engagement with the Americans on this stuff so we're not a bystander. In terms of carbon capture and storage, I think the cost of the current projects in Canada, it would be a mistake to judge them based on their applications in those projects and the viability of those investments from a cost-benefit analysis or a return on investment perspective based on those specific projects. I think you have to think of it from a long-term potential of commercialization and applicability both in the U.S. and China. The Americans are putting $3 billion of federal money into CCS research and development, and it's being matched by $7 billion private sector funds. And the Chinese and the Americans are incredibly engaged, and I've met with most of the energy leaders, global energy leaders, and talked to them about it. And you know, you're right when you say that we're not sure whether or not it will provide the benefits that some would promise, but we can't afford not to make important investments in a range of potential solutions. And I think we're going to need globally to ramp up investments in a range of in a menu of cleaner energy technologies, both conventional and alternative. And I don't think we should dismiss any. One final thing on the issue of the structure of government and how to deal with these things. I remember when Claire was working with John Godfrey, and John was Minister of Infrastructure. At that time, I was Minister of Public Works, and Stéphane Dion was Minister of the Environment. And at that time, we were working on an overall greening of government, from procurement to green infrastructure to buying green to building green. And, you know, we were given a sabbatical. But the fact is that I do think that the structure of government and ministries has to change. I think putting the environment over here and energy and natural resources over there and dividing those decision makers is part of the problem. And I think there needs to be a restructuring of the machinery of government around the whole areas of the three E's, energy, economy, and environment. It has to be, we can't put these people in separate rooms and expect good, sustainable, economic, and environmental decisions. And that goes right to the top. It takes the Prime Minister has to set the tone and enforce that kind of discipline in terms of thinking and in terms of action.
Pardon my reach.
Sorry.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to pass this back over to Kea to respond, and then we're going to open it up to the audience for questions. And there's a microphone on either side of the room, which hopefully work. So we'll do that right after Kea.
So I have to say it's a little bit depressing to constantly hear the U.S. held up as this sort of iconic example of how to spend right on clean energy and how to make the right investments and how to remove fossil fuel subsidies, because we are certainly not where we want to be. Speaking at civil society from the U.S., there are a lot of perverse fossil fuel subsidies on the production end, and certainly in the tax code that we are still trying to move above and beyond what has been in the last budget. And we think that a lot more money needs to be put into clean energy and a lot less money needs to be put into things that lock us in to continued use of fossil fuels. We are starting to move in the U.S. Just to clarify a little bit of the U.S. timeline, I don't think we're going to see a bill passed by the Senate by Memorial Day, but please don't get depressed when you don't see a bill passed by the U.S. Senate by Memorial Day. Senators Graham, Kerry, and Lieberman have been working very hard on this bill since early fall. it would be nearly miraculous for it to move that quickly. So I think actually one interesting thing would be to look at the G8 and G20 meetings as a deadline by which it would be very important to see U.S. Senate action. And likewise, I don't think you should get too depressed if we don't have a final bill by November. There's this tricky game that people like to play in Washington, D.C. around what we call lame duck sessions. So even though it will be very hard in the next congressional session in the U.S. because people who advocate for action on climate change will lose seats, most likely, unfortunately. A very big potential for what will happen. In fact, what most of us in Washington, D.C. see as an ideal case scenario is that the bill passes through the Senate, the elections happen, and after the election, in that lame duck session, before the new Congress is seated, you get the final vote. So when nobody has the election hanging over their head. So please don't get too depressed in May or November if you don't see what you think you should be seeing. But I hope that you don't mind. I also maybe add to the list of things that all of you can do to help get action on climate change, which is help us in the U.S., particularly in the case that it sounds like Canadian action is so very dependent on what the U.S. does. Now is a really, really good time to call your friends in the U.S. Senate and in the U.S. Congress, for that matter, just to remind them on finance, how important it is for the way the Canadian system will be set up, that the U.S. system actually uses these auction revenues in order to fund international climate finance. It is very much in danger right now in the negotiating process in the U.S. And just a reminder to hear from other countries in the world how important these finances are would be really, really important right now. So I would encourage everybody here to pick up the phone to their friends and just give a gentle reminder that this is an international priority for many of their close allies.
Thank you, Kay. A very important point.
If I could add just a little anecdote, I asked for my last trip to Washington, and Kay might appreciate this, but and I hope you do. But the I met with Congressman Jeff Davis from Kentucky. And he's a climate change denier. And he said, if this IPCC stuff, that bunch, even if they were right, y'all in Canada ought to be happy about that, because you're going to be able to grow stuff year-round. And I said, well, I'm from Nova Scotia. We're going to be underwater. He said, look, there's winners and losers and all this stuff. I really hope we see movement on this in the U.S. What's interesting is, in terms of the Senate bill, the proposal of a carbon tax on transportation fuels at the refinery and a cap and trade on utilities, and you know, any movement is good. But what's interesting is, because of the collapse of financial markets and the loss of credibility of financial markets, there's been a movement among Republicans against cap and trade and towards carbon tax, which is quite interesting, having been co-chair of the last Liberal Platform Committee. I have some awareness of how to sell a carbon tax really effectively in Canada. But it is interesting, and I think notwithstanding whatever our party's previous positions are on these issues, I think we should be aware that the U.S. is actually perhaps closer, ironically, to embracing a new tax than we are in Canada, despite the Tea Partiers and the rest of this stuff going on. Sorry.
So we'll now open it up to questions from the floor for anyone here.
Okay. Hi, I'm Fraser Bradley King with the Halifax Initiative, and it's a good segue maybe to my question, because I want to ask about tax, and it's always the dirty word in the room, and I'd like to try and change that. Something that struck me yesterday in a meeting with some finance officials on the World Bank has just started its new replenishment of its grant window for least developed countries. And right now, the best hope is that they'll be able to maintain a level. There's no expectation that they could increase the amount of funding that goes to least developed countries in their commitments. But they're hoping that it won't at least decrease. Everybody is coming to the table saying it's a financial crisis. Our economy is strapped. We're not able to commit any more resources. Canada, we've seen, is is going to flatline its aid budget next year. In real terms, the aid budget will actually decrease. You have an economist from the Paris University, Bruno Jetin, who has estimated that to cover the cost of the Millennium Development Goals, climate change mitigation and adaptation, developing country deficits and debts, it's going to cost approximately $710 billion a year in 2012 to 2014. The aid budget at its peak for all OECD countries hit $120 billion. So that's quite a gap that we're facing. Today, and a couple of colleagues here launched a campaign called the Robin Hood tax, or the financial transactions tax, which a number of you have talked about. And I'm just curious to know, again, an economist in Austria has estimated that a small tax on financial transactions, 0.05%, could generate anywhere between $210 billion and just over $1 trillion. So if you pick the middle, $650 billion. We know the conservative government is opposed to a bank levy, a tax, anything that would move us forward. He's even opposed the move in Europe for a bank levy. And I'm just wondering what each of the parties is going to do to try and promote this idea of a financial transactions tax. I know tax is a word that hangs on all of your party leaders' shoulders, but if we think back to 11 years ago in 1999, Canada's parliament was the first parliament in the world to support a motion tabled by the NDP, but supported by the Blocs, the Liberals, and the NDP, and I think even maybe some Conservatives, for a transaction tax on or a tax on financial transactions. So what are each of your parties going to do to help move this issue forward?
Well, and I just because I'm not to be the skunk at the picnic, but I was one of the MPs voted against that in 1999. The Tobin tax, it's kind of like the Loch Ness monster. There's a sighting every few years, and then it goes down, and someone talks about it again in a few years. And there are some very now, and I don't think we should say that, given what has just happened in the global financial crisis, we should write off any idea or another, and I'm open to looking again at it and considering it in the current context. I'm certainly not going to commit to it and say it's our, you know, because I think that far too often on motions on the floor of the House of Commons, there are votes where people do that which is politically palatable without necessarily a long-term commitment to doing anything about them. But the issue of putting a tax on financial transactions on a global basis, I don't think is as important as the importance of trade engagement with the developing world and the movement from aid provision to trade and economic engagement. And if you look at the failure of Canada, of countries like Canada and in the industrialized world, to deal with our differences and our self-interest on issues like the Doha Round, the WTO, I think we have a moral responsibility to get the Doha round on track. And we've all, but everyone's given up on Doha. And people have given up on multilateralism in terms of trade liberalization. And everyone's going bilateral now. And I think that that's unfortunate. I think that frankly, the hypocrisy of saying to the developing world, we're going to give you more money, we've got to give more money to the developing world, but by God, we can't buy their products, is shocking. So I think that this is something that across ideological divides within our parliament and elsewhere, we have to recognize the important role of trade to helping the developing world. And if you look at what's happening now between China and Africa and the role China is playing in Africa right now, it is not a totally exploitative one, and it is not a totally negative one. In fact, if you were to speak with many African leaders, including NGO leaders, they see that the role China is playing as an investor and as a trade partner is actually fairly constructive in many ways. So I'm just positing a couple of thoughts beyond this.
I can't say what the NDP did in 1999, I'm afraid. My guess would be is they probably favored it. Proposed it. There you are. Good for us. I would and there you are. You see, you say that parties should work across the way. Okay, well, you guys can come on board this time.
Well, the Liberals did last time.
Well, there you are. I prefer not to just look at one singularly. I think that a whole array of mechanisms need to be looked at because I see it's important to share the load. I think what we need, too, is we need a context within which we look at. Oh, now we got like a million of these on. We need a context within which we look at these. First of all, I mean, we have committed that we will give aid, but 4, 5, 6 times over. And I think what we need to do is we need to look at it in terms of, it's the same way where TransAlta, I finally forced TransAlta legally be obliged to return the lake, the water to the lake that they had taken from my lake for 60 years. And it's divided into two. One was the historical debt up to the point in time where we got them to agree. And then there's the debt going forward. And I see that with the climate debt. I think we need to be seen looking at those in two perspectives. So it's not just going forward. We have this huge historical debt. And I think that's where they're proportioning out, right? It's proportion based both on how much of the greenhouse gases we're responsible for in this country. And then also looking at what are our capabilities to be able to contribute to both reduce here and to help other countries to develop a clean energy path, which would be my preference first and foremost, and then secondly to adapt. I think that by the time we're talking about adapting, we're really, it's like too late. So I think that's where I see the major investment. I'd like to see us look at the global financial transaction tax. I also like the idea of the currency transaction tax, but I really like the idea of an emission allowance fee, a portion of the emission allowance going towards this purpose. But that, of course, is going to mean that we're going to have to go towards cap and trade. But if certain jurisdictions, say provinces, Canadian provinces, could, you know, some of them are going in the direction of a carbon tax, maybe a portion of the carbon tax, and maybe this needs to be looked at, you know, proportionately federal and provincial revenue-wise. So there's no doubt about it at all that we need to be stepping up to the plate, imposing something, and I don't care what it is, but I think it should be a broad array, and I don't think that Canadians, individual families, should be having to simply bear the brunt. I think it's time that those who are profiting by continued use of fossil fuels should be taking that brunt.
Oui, d'entrée de jeu, je pense que je l'ai indiqué, on est assez
favorable. At the outset, we're quite favorable to a tax on financial transactions. I indicated that that would be a mechanism. But a little history lesson, the motion tabled by the NDP in 1999, if I'm not mistaken, it was tabled by my former colleague, Lauren Nystrom. It wasn't a token tax, it was a tax on financial transactions. We have to be prudent because in the end, it can be a tax on small savers. And what we want is a tax, the aim of which is to avoid financial speculation. So yes, tax, but a tax through transactions against speculation. Why? Because simply history tells us that Canada does not respect its commitments with regard to assistance to developing countries. Remember, Canada committed itself to 0.7% of its GDP being devoted to ODA. And we never reached that objective, that target that we promised the UN. So if we're tabling on the fact that there's going to be a Canadian contribution to adaptation to climate change, then we're going to be waiting a long time because we've never respected our commitment with regard to assistance for developing countries. And that's why I believe that we require a tax on financial transactions, but a tax that is aimed at speculation. And indeed, I think it would be a good mechanism for funding a climate change adaptation.
Maybe just one final point. It isn't a Tobin tax. It's on all financial transactions. Tobin was just on currency. These are very different times from 10 years ago. The trade in financial assets every year peaked in 2007 at around $73 trillion. Global trade, $16 trillion.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. And I think it's important to recognize times are different, but it's also important to recognize what really was the cause of the global financial crisis. And I think it would be unfair to say it was purely speculation or transactional speculation. I think it's also
while I recognize the need to raise the money, and as such, tax is playing a role in that, for international development, I don't know if tying it to financial transactions or speculation is the best way. So I want to, you know, I've run on a carbon tax, so my views on this matter are fairly well known as an individual. I remember there wasn't unanimity in terms of that, in terms of our political process the last election. But you can raise a lot of money with carbon taxes as an example. And I think if you want to talk about what is a worse, you know, if you want to tax what's bad, I think taxing carbon is probably at least as sensible as taxing speculation.
So my name is Robert Fox. I'm with Oxfam Canada. And I don't actually have a question, but I have a comment that may lapse into a lament that may provide you an opportunity to share in my misery and maybe suggest some action. So as has been pointed out, Canada has not yet made any commitments with respect to adaptation. And while it is obscene that we should need to be focusing on adaptation at this time, it is very much part of what confronts us. The sense among many Canadians is that climate change is a threat on the horizon that we're trying to avert, and yet those of us who are more clear about this issue are very clear that, in fact, the women and girls of Africa have been reeling from the impact of climate change for a generation now, and that we measured climate change not in parts per million or in degrees centigrade, but we measure it in terms of the number of hours that women are spending each day finding and fetching water, the number of hours that girls are pulled out of school because they too are oppressed in that work, the number of hours each day that the people of Bangladesh spend basically separating salt water from the earth earth from the salt water that is washing the sea in order to rebuild their paddies and try and survive on an eroding piece of land. And so in that context, it's particularly lamentable that Canada hasn't made the commitment. And when we look at the last federal budget and see that Minister Flaherty has indicated that there will be a cap on increase in foreign official development assistance next year and moving forward, then that is all the more alarming, because there is been ever more competition for scarce resources. There's been no statement from this government at all that funding for adaptation will be new and additional and over and above what should be increasing commitments that fell this past year. We were at 0.33, far from our target. And in fact, the latest OECD figures indicate that we have fallen further from that target. In a world in which the portion of the pie is being compared against a smaller pie. So this is just bad news upon bad news in terms of lack of commitment and lack of clarity on the part of this government. And while the environment ministers haven't been meeting, the finance ministers have, and our minister is in fact leading the world in the opposite direction to where we should be going in this. And in speaking with Korean officials, they've already in some cases written off Toronto, because they say we won't be able to do it in Toronto because the hosts aren't open to it, so they're already planning for Seoul. As a Canadian, I'm embarrassed to think that in fact the world is saying Toronto, there's no chance for change. We'll focus where there is a host that is open and committed to advancing these agendas. But at the end of the day, it isn't about my pride as a Canadian. It is about my outrage as a human being and a citizen of this planet that we aren't doing what we must be doing. And I believe there's been a really clear signal from Canadians that they understand the urgency of this issue and they're committed to action on this issue. And so any advice you have in terms of more we might be doing on that to put pressure on this government, or any information you can offer in terms of what you are doing to put pressure on this government, would be most welcome.
I'm going to excuse MPs if they do need to go, because
I have to go. I just want to thank, and frankly, we couldn't be more eloquent than you just in terms of your expression of frustration. And I know this is not a partisan meeting, but let me be not a partisan, but just a frustrated Canadian. I'm very frustrated with the lack of leadership internationally from the government. And we're frittering away an opportunity at G8 and G20 to really make a huge difference. I've got to be in the House, but I want to thank you for having organized this. It's really terrific. And my colleagues for their participation and for all of you, and I hope we can do more of these on a range of topics. I do have to go. I'm not avoiding your questions. Okay, so thank
good time
you.
To go.
Thank you for the day. We'll still continue, but
speak well of me when I'm gone.
Thank you, Scott. And we're actually going to take the other two questions, and then we'll have them respond to all of the questions.
Thank you very much to the organizers of this opportunity for us to participate in a dialogue about this issue. My name is Suzanne Tamas. I represent the Baha'i community of Canada, and our community is a member of the Interfaith Partnership for the G8 G20. So I'd like to comment on two things. The first is to say that this discussion today, taken at face value, could be misunderstood as an economic and utilitarian analysis of a very material problem that needs to be addressed in those ways. But it is far more than that, because underneath this economic utilitarian analysis is the question of who caused this problem, who's responsible for this problem, who pays for this problem, who gets to talk about what the answers are, the solutions are to this problem. And these are all highly moral or ethical, and people of faith would say spiritually grounded questions. The worry that I have about finding the basis for action in our economy is that if it were not economically positive to support green energy or other things to respond to climate change, does that mean that we wouldn't do it? Well, no, there has to be an answer, a motivation that is far deeper rooted than that, that irrespective of the consequences, we have an obligation to the people on this planet to make whatever sacrifices are necessary and to welcome whatever opportunities this brings to live together as a human family without the extremes of wealth and poverty that we currently witness. So in order to develop political will, the faith communities in Canada are being encouraged to invite their MPs to dinner. The Interfaith Partnership has produced a statement that discusses very briefly climate change, poverty, and peace. And it has asked people of faith across Canada to invite their MP for dinner and to sit down and discuss the statement with them in the hope that not prescribing what the answer might be, but looking at what are the underlying values that we hope would inform our policymakers and decision makers as they go to the table to discuss these things. So it's an effort for them to learn, but also to draw attention to the underlying moral imperative that we need to bring to this table. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Stephen Hazel, a private citizen, formerly with CIRCLA. The Conservatives decided not to send a representative today, and that, in a way, kind of typifies the problem that we've got in this country. And I think it, to some extent, applies to the United States as well, is that climate change is increasingly becoming a partisan political issue. That in Canada, you've got the three main opposition parties on one side of the issue and the Conservatives on the other. And the Conservatives, they don't seem to want to hear anything that challenges the way the government wants to do business. But I think it's really important that we learn to talk to Conservatives. And the fact that Senator Graham is involved is really, I think, kind of a dramatic breakthrough in a way. But this is a huge problem, because many of us in this room, some of the graybeards in the room, we've been at this for 20 years. It was a Conservative government in 1990 that first committed to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Mulroney did it in the Green Plan. And we have made no progress since then. And I think, in terms of public opinion, maybe contrary to what some colleagues have just said, I think we're actually further behind, because I think most Canadians have their hands up in the air. They don't really know whether it's something, the climate, we should be worried about or not. So we've lost ground. And I think we really have to sort of focus on how can we talk to Conservatives to convince them that this is something that they should be concerned about. And the previous speaker, I think, identified one interesting way, and that is through the faith community. I mean, I think getting faith community talking to members of Parliament, I think it's crucial. I mean, the ones you really got to talk to are the Conservative MPs, because I think, by and large, the NDP bloc and Liberals are convinced. But, you know, we've got to figure something out, because, you know, this government could be around for a long time. We can't, like, the environment community, we have this hope that, well, you know, if we could just elect the Liberals, things would be so much better. Well, when we had Mulroney and we elected Krajicek, boy, a lot of us were thinking back, gee, Mulroney wasn't so bad after all. So we can't expect that things are going to get so much better when the Liberals are, if and when the Liberals are. We have to work with the guys and gals that we've got, and they've been atrocious, but I think we've got to focus on them, because then they don't seem to want to talk to anybody. But that's the challenge. So any thoughts on that would be appreciated.
So we have ethics, partisanship, and development. Ready, go.
My two cents. All I can say is it's great that Oxfam and other organizations are stepping up to the table. One of the actions this year that happened that cheered me most was the recommendation from the panel looking at the duty to intervene, included in one of their four or five triggers, is climate. So if in, you know, that level of people working, you know, on peace and disarmament and so forth, recognize that climate is an issue, I think we're making progress. Unfortunately, as Stephen very clearly points out, the one group in society that seems to be out of sync with the rest of Canada are our elected governments. And not all elected members, but those who are in power, and I can say that clearly because I come from Alberta, so I'm suffering that fate both federally and provincially. I was lucky to participate in a United Church event in Toronto last week, and I think there were some evangelicals and maybe Baha'i there. I'm just not sure who all the participants were. And I was really, really inspired by that session. Very inspired by the fact the moderator of United Church has actually issued a document, a letter, to all of the congregations, which has been shared with all of the congregations. And the very active role that United Church and some other churches played actually at Copenhagen, and certainly churches from around the world. So I think that certainly in the conversations I'm having with people, we have very much moved into the issue of ethics, that ethics is going to be front and center on this, and certainly our duty to intervene and to respond, but also, first, you shall do no harm, right? So I don't think that our country, I find it really, really reprehensible that we would think that we can make it up for our past sins simply by doling out money. I think first and foremost, our obligation is to reduce our emissions, because it's going to be, you know, we say this is going to be the scale of, you know, 400, 500 billion. How do we know what this, I mean, in many cases, money is not going to help. Scott Bryson was suggesting certain actions that we can take. I said, well, I don't think that the Maldives and Tuvalu, oh, no, he's promoting, you know, trade. Well, we should be trading. I don't think the trade with Tuvalu and the Maldives is a solution that they're looking for. I mean, they're losing their entire country. So do I think it's moved into the ethical realm? I think it was always in the ethical realm. And that's why my work has always focused on environmental justice. And if ever there was an environmental justice issue, climate is it.
D'abord, effectivement, le représentant d'Oxfam, il y a vraiment un écart entre l'aide.
There's really a gap between official assistance and this form of aid. And you gave an eloquent explanation in one of your reports, demonstrating that the needs for adapting to climate change will be of a cost of about $50 billion per year, whereas the contribution at present of industrialized countries is $48 million. So there's a gap between the needs and the contribution on the part of industrialized countries for adaptation to climate change. And we see this concretely in the funding granted by these countries. In passing to the Baha'i believer, I've met a lot of your colleagues in my writing, and I think you've contributed greatly. We, each and every one of us, contribute in our own way to the fight against climate change, and this is a mechanism for developing society. It's fair, acceptable, and it's a very important and noble contribution to the fight against climate change. And churches have contributed, religious groups. I'm thinking of development and peace. They did considerable work in the past. Kairos, too. It was one of the first organizations that enhanced awareness to climate change. They were very tenacious, very perseverant, and every year they came to visit with us in our offices on the Hill. And I link this to what Mr. Azar was saying. What has this done? Well, the conservative government slashed funding, so we can talk to them. We can have discussions, but perhaps Linda, who beat a conservative, and who is close to that base, could inspire me, but I don't find the words to talk to these people. But it is clear that we have to have that discussion. Look at the polls. And here we're talking more politics, but look at the public opinion polls. There's an important critical mass of Canadian citizens who continue to support the Conservative government. We're talking here about a gap. The worst poll gives a 10% advantage to them, so it varies between 5 and 10, which means there's a majority of Canadians who continue to support the Conservative government. So we have to concern ourselves with that political party, but also Canadian voters who give them the mandate, who give them the power. It's not the Holy Spirit that's intervened here in this. Those people are in power because they got a mandate from the people, so that we have to have discussions with the Conservatives, but also with the citizens who give them support and to understand and why they continue to support that form, that type of government.
Thank you
very much.
Claire, did you have one more question or comment?
Oh, that's okay, because we're over time.
Yeah.
Great discussion.
All right, well, I'd like to thank our panelists, Linda Duncan, Daphna Abdiqad, Scott Bryson, who has now left the room. I think that this kind of a discussion is really necessary, and I'm really glad that we had a lot of people in the room today. I think that this is actually a perfect number to have a really close and frank discussion. Alors, merci beaucoup. C'était un plaisir.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure. Have a nice day.